Well, as promised, here's number two. There once was a bishop in Kent who constantly said what he meant. His straightforward talk caused the whole world to balk, but he never buckled or bent.
As rhyme and rhythm.
Yeah. Very well. I'm going to start this with an extension of something I was talking about in the first talk, and just hinted at. But Dickens was not clearly a writer who had the Catholic faith. But if you remember, in the liaison comment that His Excellency sent out announcing this gathering, which is indeed now taking place, at the very end of it, he quotes another non-Catholic writer, to my mind, the other great literary figure, novelist of the 19th century, and that's Fyodor Dostoevsky. And Dostoevsky refers to that great Christian Dickens. And if we can make that kind of distinction, I think the distinction is worth making. Dostoevsky himself claimed that he learned much of novel writing by reading the Pickwick Papers and David Copperfield, which he knew very well. He was very fond of Dickens. Dickens helped him through a difficult period in his own life and was a teacher to him. And here's something interesting, and this again goes to what I was saying earlier. We have to be very careful in rejecting writers who do not fully meet our standards completely. Dostoevsky predicts in at least two of his novels the event, I think, we are all still waiting for with deep yearning. And that is the consecration of Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the conversion of Russia, and her triumph. There is, in The Brothers Karamazov, one of his two most famous novels, the other is Crime and Punishment, Father Zosima, the great holy monk, who has written his memoirs and is talking to the young monk Alyosha, and speaks of the fact that when the light is restored, it will be restored from the east, and that Russia will be the place where the light dawns again and then shines throughout the whole world. Russia will be converted, my Immaculate Heart will triumph, and a period of peace will be given to the world, which means it will begin in Russia, which will become Catholic, and then that will bring a period of world peace, which to my mind means the whole world must be Catholic. The other curious one is in his novel called Demons, about the young radicals, and he saw the coming of the horrors of the revolution in the 20th century. It's about the madness of these young men, the madness that grips Russia. Well, one of the old characters, old Stepan Verkhovensky, who is a liberal professor, who has taught liberalism, raised his own son and taught other young people to not believe in God, but to believe in the revolution, at the end of the novel has a Dickensian redemption scene. He comes to understand his error. He is desperately upset with what he has done. And following along with him as he is headed off on his own, an old man stumbling off, is a woman who is giving out Bibles. She's just called the Bible Lady. And she stays with him, and as he's dying, he asks her to read to him a passage from the Gospels. And it's about the Gadarene swine. And the swine have the demons driven out. The demons are driven out of the madman into the swine, who race down the hill and throw themselves off a cliff. But that passage ends with the statement that the madman then healed went and sat at the feet of Christ, and the world was astonished. And old Stepan Verkhovensky says, that's us. It's our Russia. The demons are possessing us. But through God's grace, those demons will be driven out of us. We are now the Gadarene swine. We will run off the cliff and destroy ourselves. But Russia, having been healed, having come to her senses, will go and sit at the feet of Christ, and the world will be amazed. I find it simply astonishing. We know for a fact that certain artists are also given touches of prophecy. And there it is in Dostoevsky. So when he calls Dickens a great Christian, I think he knows what he's talking about. Dickens doesn't do prophecy like that, but he has within him a certain core of faith that was never shaken. Interestingly enough, Peter Ackroyd in his biography says he believes some of it in Dickens came from his devotion to fairy tales when he was young. Here's the quotation. Fairy tales contain for him religious associations. Hard to say where his adult religion begins and his childhood love of the marvelous ends. He believed in the marvelous. He believed in transformation. He believed in miracles. And as a result, it's interesting as well that Shakespeare's last four plays end up being fairy tale plays. And they are deeply religious plays. That the fairy tale has something in it in terms of morality, the miraculous, and the sense of happy ending, but it comes after some sort of judgment, is everywhere in Dickens. He talks about his own endings and says that his endings, and he was accused the endings are often prepared and set up, and he said, yes, that's the case. He said, my endings, the ways of providence, of which all art is but a little imitation. So that the providential endings of the proper judgment of the characters, depending on how they have lived their lives and the choices they have made, Dickens himself connected with providence, a judgment, and the reward is handed out appropriately to how they have lived. He was told that he had very many readers in Russia, and he was surprised by it. But he made the following comment. Yes, there is so much suffering in Russia that what I have tried to say must certainly find many hearts open there to receive it. And the fact of the matter is, in this he's pre-echoing the great writer of our own time, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who stated very emphatically, Russia, the Russian people have a depth of spirituality in them unknown in the West because of the immense suffering they have been through. And I know many of us believe that the West is overdue for suffering, and when it comes, God have mercy on us and God help us. It will be a great good, and it will be absolutely necessary in order to begin some sort of restoration. Let me just give you a few other quotations. Again, Dickens' own comments, as close as open religious comments as he ever made. He once wrote, I hold our Savior to be the model of all goodness. And I assume that in a Christian country where the New Testament is accessible to all men, all goodness must be referred back to its influence. When his youngest son was about to depart for Australia, Dickens said to him, "The New Testament is the best book that ever was or ever will be known in the world. I now most solemnly impress upon you the truth and the beauty of the Christian religion as it came from Christ himself." Fairly strong. On another occasion, his sister had suffered a great loss, and he wrote a letter in which he consoled her by saying, "There is no stay in this world. but the hope of a better. And there is no reliance but on the mercy and goodness of God. It gives you a sense of what he thought, where he was. But I came upon this, which I find the most astonishing, and in a way a bit sad. It was shortly after Mary Hogarth's death, and I mentioned her death before, and I'll mention it again in connection with Bleak House. He suddenly had a dream, and he dreamt that a spirit appeared to him. It was in the dream, and he believed, he took it to be Mary Hogarth. He thought it was, as he said, poor Mary's spirit. He said, "Forgive me. We poor living creatures are only able to express ourselves by looks and words. I have used the word most natural to our affections. I call you dear because you know my heart." The spirit said nothing, and Dickens began to sob. "Give me some token that you have visited me." The spirit said, "Form a wish." Dickens said, "Mrs. Hogarth is surrounded by great distresses. Will you help extricate her?" The spirit said, "Yes." Dickens, "And her extrication is to be a certainty to me that this has already really happened?" The spirit said, "Yes." "But," Dickens says, "answer me one other question. What is the true religion? Do you think, as I do, that the form of religion does not so greatly matter if we try to be good? Or perhaps the Roman Catholic is the best religion. Perhaps it makes one think of God oftener and believe in him more steadily." And the Spirit said, "For you it is the best." He never converted. He never converted. But he was told. So, God judges, and we appreciate the good work he did in this world. But I wanted to get that in. Now, I'm going to talk about Bleak House, and I chose this because it was written immediately after David Copperfield. There is a turn, there is a change in Dickens' writing, Dickens' vision, that occurs at this moment in this novel. There had certainly been, in all the earlier novels, characters who are good, characters who are evil. I've made that point. But with Bleak House, a certain degree of comic joy goes out of his writing. A certain freedom of expression goes out of his writing. He begins to view the world as possessed of a kind of darkness that goes on beyond the merely personal choices of some bad men and women. And he begins to see that something is spreading throughout the world that is more sinister, that is darker, that is larger than individuals, and that is threatening to the joy, the peace, and the well-being of mankind. Not just particular individuals in that world. What I'm going to do is read just the very end of David Copperfield, just one image. I can't read it all. I can't give away the final ending for those of you who don't know it. "Now as I close my task, subduing my desire to linger yet, these faces fade away." It's David finishing his autobiography. "But one face, shining on me like a heavenly light by which I see all other objects, is above them and beyond them all, and that face remains." The one single face shining on him that reminds him of the heavenly light and draws him upward. I am now going to read the entire opening of Bleak House. It's about a page and a half. It is indeed one of the most famous openings in all of English literature. Chapter 1, In Chancery. London, Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets, as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth. And it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in mire. Horses, scarcely better, splashed to the very blinkers. Foot passengers, jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper and losing their foothold at street corners, where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest. Fog everywhere. Fog up the river where it flows among green eights and meadows. Fog down the river where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes, fog on the Kentish heights, fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs, fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships, fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats, fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners wheezing by the firesides of their wards, fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper down in his closed cabin, fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of the shivering little prentice boy on deck, chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all around them as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds, gas looming through the fog in divers places in the streets, much as the sun may from the spongy fields be seen to loom by husbandman and plowboy, most of the shops lighted 2 hours before their time, as the gas seems to know, for it has a haggard and unwilling look. The raw afternoon is rawest, and the dense fog is densest, and the muddy streets are muddiest. Near the leaden-headed old obstruction, appropriate ornament for the threshold of a leaden-headed old corporation, Temple Bar. And hard by Temple Bar, in Lincoln's Inn Hall, at the very heart of the fog, sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery. Never came there fog too thick. Never can there come mud and mire too deep to assort with the groping and floundering condition which this High Court of Chancery, most pestilent of hoary sinners, holds this day in the sight of heaven and earth. In the Pickwick Papers, there's a character who proclaims comically, "The law, sir, the law's an ass." Here the law has become pestilent. And it's not that law is wrong. It is the tradition of the courts that have been taken over by something other than justice and become an institution that is dead, perpetuating itself in its deadness, deadly to those who have to come near it, appeal to it, or seek justice from it, and that pestilence and death is a mockery of the divine justice it should reflect as best as possible in an earthly way, and it is spreading that fog and darkness and pestilence everywhere in the social order. I will hit on some other established bases of the social order that Dickens links with that court. We get a kind of network of foggy, muddy, dark, dead, pestilent institutions that are killing mankind as we go throughout the book. but he focuses it first and foremost on justice, because in his heart, in the way he designed his novels, he somehow knew it was necessary for justice to be given to individuals according to how they have lived their lives. The classic definition of justice, giving to each man what he has earned and deserves. In the same way that on the day of judgment, when we stand before God and God hands out his judgment to us, it will be in line with what we have earned and deserved. And what Dickens saw was the institution had stopped fulfilling its function, and instead of meeting out justice, was meeting out death. The center of the novel is a lawsuit called Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. Over the course of the novel, we get some little hints about what it was about, but it has been dragging on for so many years that the actual nature of the lawsuit is not as important as the fact that it can never reach a settlement. It just goes on and on, with more lawyers entering, with more contention, with more time spent in the courts. And Dickens was prompted to write about this imaginary case from a very real case that was going on at his time. It was called the Jennings case, and it was in the Court of Chancery. Jennings was an old miser who had died, and died with an inheritance of millions of pounds, but he left no will. And as a result, and quite understandably, everybody around him, everybody who knew him, close relatives, distant relatives, neighbors, friends, anyone who had any connection with him, wanted some of that money. The lawsuit was introduced in court in 1798. When Dickens writes Bleak House in 1851, it was still going on. 53 years later, when it was settled, Dickens had been dead for nearly 80 years. The Jennings case stretched from 1798 to 1915. And when the Jennings case was finally settled, there was nothing left to distribute. Every cent had gone to the lawyers. Now, one may find, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible. There are some critics who stated that Dickens is exaggerating in presenting Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. In fact, what he does is reduce the actual horror of what was going on, because the Jennings case just went on and on and on. I will tell you, this is a true story. By the way, the notion of justice is it must be fair and quick. It's one of the standard ideas. You should not have to wait and wait and wait to receive justice. Well, this makes a mockery of that idea. And very sadly, there is a reason. The very people who should be involved in distributing justice, ruling on justice, have indeed a monetary interest in prolonging these cases. A number of them are in the book. Again, I'm going to try to not give away a lot of plot. If you haven't read Bleak House, you must. It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece. I knew a family. The father was a very wealthy, very successful businessman. He died in his mid-80s, and his family was shocked to discover he never made a will. There was no will. The same thing happened. What should have been a simple case of the wife receiving amount, the children receiving amount, turned into Jarndyce versus Jarndyce, where suddenly out of the woodwork came other relatives, other business associates. It went into court. It went on for years. And when it was finished, there was very, very little left to distribute. The money went to the lawyers. We can now see a very, very similar case in what's happening with our insane pursuit of health in the modern world. By the way, Plato says, I think it's in the Republic, isn't it, Pat? Plato says in the Republic that you can tell the health of any society by how few lawyers and doctors are in that society. And it's very logical because, one, if you have lawyers, 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 lawyers everywhere, if you have a society that is just crammed with lawyers, what it means is there is no common moral vision. And everything becomes contentious. No two human beings can settle anything amicably on their own. And everything has to go to trial, and bingo, up come the lawyers. In the same way, if you have a society as ours is that believes the highest and only human good is keeping this bodily machine running, and that there's nothing more we can hope for, then it is absolutely necessary that every single flaw, problem, ache, or pain, or whatever in this body has to be taken care of immediately to keep the thing running. And therefore, we become dependent on the doctors, and more doctors spring up to write prescriptions, to give pills, to cut out parts of you, to put in new parts of you, to rearrange your innards, to give you a new heart or a new liver or a new kidney, when what the modern world really needs is transplanted brains, which will give them some knowledge of the soul, which they've completely forgotten, and realize that this life is but a preparation for the next, and it is a veil of tears, and through bodily suffering, we may often earn our way to heaven. Too many lawyers, too many doctors. By the way, to be fair to Mr. Shaw again, if Bleak House is the book that attacks lawyers, there is a wonderful Shaw play I would encourage you to read. It's only rarely done. It's called The Doctor's Dilemma, and it is a... Shaw, God bless him, hated doctors. What happened was he was given a vaccine when he was very young to prevent smallpox, and indeed got smallpox. And the reason he always wore that long beard was because the lower part of his face was desperately scarred, and he covered it with that big beard. He had a lifelong resentment against doctors. The Doctor's Dilemma is a very funny, very troubling, a well-written play, and it has a plot. He put a story in it. But also, treat yourself to the preface before the play where Shaw talks about the medical profession. If you need some laughs, or if you're annoyed with your doctor, be sure to read it. In any case, what Dickens is doing in Bleak House is going after the lawyers. Now, he takes a case, an imaginary case, Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. This family has been ripped apart, overwrought. The case has been going on, and nothing happens. And one wise, sensible person in the family who has tried to withdraw himself, who's a decent older man, Mr. Jarndyce, is still troubled by it. There's a wonderful thing. Whenever he starts thinking about the case or what's happened to the family, he says, the wind is coming from the east. The wind is coming, and he starts to get troubled. So even a balanced man, and he is the one who resides in Bleak House, I don't want to give too much more detail, but let's just say he has some young wards. And he fears for them because they are in the Jarndyce family. They're going to be drawn in, so he tries to protect them. He brings them to Bleak House. And when they arrive, they first come to London before they go off to the house. They go there, and they're at the Court of Chancery. And they meet a poor, desperate, crazy old woman named Miss Flight. Mad as a hatter. And what has happened is, years ago, Miss Flight had a similar law case. And she has been returning to the court every day for year after year after year after year, always bringing more papers, More testimony that she hopes can be introduced. Nothing ever comes of her case. It's driven her stark raving mad, but she is addicted to going every day to sit in court and thinking maybe her case will come up and there will be a ruling. And she's talking to the young wards outside the court. One of the lawyers dismisses her and says, now, don't be troublesome. That's a good soul, trying to drive her away. By no means, said the poor old lady, keeping up with aid in me, anything but troublesome. I shall confer estates on both, which is not being troublesome, I trust. I expect a judgment shortly, on the day of judgment. This is a good omen for you. Accept my blessing. Once again, truth and madness. She will get her judgment on the day of judgment. She becomes an important figure in all the way through the novel. One of Dickens' unforgettable creations. But we get some descriptions of what the case has been about and what it's done. Tom Jarndyce, the sensible older man who's tried to withdraw himself from it so he can have some life apart, tells the young wards, for it's being ground to bits in a slow mill. It's being roasted at a slow fire. It's being stung to death by single bees. It's being drowned by drops. It's going mad by grains. He was as near making away with himself as could possibly be. We listened with horror. It still affected the man, even though he's had the sense to remove himself. Another comment from one of the young wards. I'm grieved that I should be the enemy, and suppose I am, of a great number of relations and others, and that they should be my enemies, as I suppose they are, and that we should all be ruining one another without knowing how or why, and be in constant doubt and discord all our lives. It seems very strange, as there must be right somewhere, that an honest judge in real earnest has not been able to find out through all the years where it is. There's got to be truth, the right, justice out there somewhere. Why can't anyone find it? And what Dickens knew is that it was being deliberately obscured by a system of fog and pestilence in order to keep individual souls under its grip, to thrust them down, to control them, to demoralize them, to turn them into helpless, helpless sheep that can be guided about. Because our Lord himself told us we are sheep, and if we're not guided by the good shepherd, then we're going to be guided by the wolves waiting to devour us. And what Dickens saw is that many of these institutions had become wolfish and were eating up the innocent just to perpetuate themselves and perpetuate their own wealth and to perpetuate their own power. There is another gentleman named Mr. Gridley who has had the same thing happen to him. And Dickens gives him one of the central outbursts in the entire novel and labels it what we still know it to be, and we still use the phrase. What is it that gets us? The system. And you can't buck the system. Because no matter how hard you try to buck the system, they will get you. The system, Mr. Gridley, with no diminution of his rage. I am told on all hands, it's the system. I mustn't look to individuals. It's the system. I mustn't go into court and say, my Lord, I beg to know this from you. Is this right or wrong? Have you the face to tell me I have received justice and therefore am dismissed? My Lord knows nothing of it. He sits there to administer the system. I mustn't go to Mr. Tulkinghorn, the solicitor in Lincoln's Inn Fields, and say to him when he makes me furious by being so cool and satisfied, as they all do, for I know they gain by it while I lose, don't I? I mustn't say to him, I will have something out of someone for my ruin, by fair means or foul. He is not responsible. It's the system. But if I do no violence to any of them here, I don't know what may happen if I am carried beyond myself at last. I will accuse the individual workers of that system against me face to face before the great eternal bar. It's powerful stuff. It's powerful stuff. But it is the recognition the only justice left to such an individual is divine justice at the end of time. It is, it's the other side of poor Mad Miss Flights. I expect a judgment on the day of judgment. And it's Dickens again saying, the only hope we have in this world, the only stay, is looking forward to a better one. And at this moment in his life, the novels turn darker because he saw that system encroaching absolutely everywhere. Now, he's a comic writer. The comedy is still there. It's darker. There is, Miss Flight lives in this run-down, terrible old house run by a man named Mr. Crook. K-R-O-O-K. And his ghastly establishment, he collects old papers, old everything, old bones. Nobody knows what's in Mr. Crook's house. It's simply a grisly establishment where this old man is drawing in everything, and when he draws it in, he never lets it out again. And he calls himself the brother of the Lord Justice of Chancery. Oh, he's my brother, says Mr. Crook. And the point is, what we have in Crook's horror hole of a home is a comic mockery of what is going on in the Court of Chancery. That hellhole will become central to what happens in the novel. And there will be more justice somehow coming out of that hellhole of Mr. Crook's that can come out of the Court of Chancery. And I hate to give this away, but I have to, because I can't talk about the novel without it. Mr. Crook gets more and more stuff into this little house of his. More and more stuff that shouldn't be there. What is it? What's it made of? What's it doing here? How's it interacting? What's he doing? There's an awful cat that prowls around through the place as well. And one night, Mr. Crook spontaneously combusts. He simply explodes while he's sitting in front of the fire. The critics skewered Dickens for this. Said it was an absurdity of the plot, it couldn't possibly happen. And Dickens, being a realist, said he put it in because he had actually investigated ahead of time and found two or three cases in England within the last few decades of human beings who had spontaneously combusted. I don't know if it's true or not, or if he made it up. I tend to trust him, because there was something of the realist in him. But the reason I have to mention it is because it is the perfect emblem of what Dickens is saying must inevitably happen to the system. The system will grind on, the system will grind on, the system will grind on, very sure of itself, very full of itself, doling out the poisons it doles out, but at some point, kabloom, it all blows up. Now, it's not just the court. He dismisses politics almost out of hand. But the notion is the political system is just as bad. But he doesn't care for it. He doesn't have really time for it. So instead we get this, which, by the way, Chesterton said, dismisses all the politics of England in about three sentences. England had been in a dreadful state for some weeks. Lord Coodle would go out. Sir Thomas Doodle wouldn't come in. And there being nobody in Great Britain to speak of except Coodle and Doodle, there had been no government. It is a mercy that the hostile meeting between these two great men which at one time seemed inevitable, did not come off. Because if both pistols had taken effect and Koodle and Doodle had killed each other, it is to be presumed that England must have waited to be governed until young Koodle and young Doodle, now in frocks and long stockings, were grown up. What he knew long ago, politics were becoming meaningless. Meaningless. Are you voting for Koodle? Are you voting for Doodle? Who should rule? Koodle's party or Doodle's party? Having been through many recent American elections, I can tell you that I just stopped voting. It didn't make any difference. Not a dime. It's one big party. Just supporting each other. Although I must tell you this is rather nice. Very fond of the people on the cruises. But they are very concerned with politics. And at one point, my dear friend, who's sort of the radio host and head of the cruise, said, anyone who would hold these political opinions must be crazy. And Patrick and I looked at each other because we hold those political opinions. But this came immediately after we had been in Lisbon and were being given a tour of the city by a very competent tour guide. And she's driving us around in her little minivan. And she said, unfortunately, we have a president right now who is not good. She said, if anything really fine happens in the country of Portugal now, he gives public thanks to Our Lady of Fatima. It means he's crazy. And Patrick and I looked at each other and said, well, we must be crazy too. So, I mean, wherever you go in the modern world, if you actually have some sense, you're quite mad. In any case, the law courts first, followed by politics, politics dismissed. And then, and this is central to the novel, the nobility. There is a very old fashionable estate that is central to the novel, where the same family has held possession and ruled over the area for a long, long time. And is controlled by Sir Leicester Dedlock. And his beautiful, much younger wife, Lady Dedlock, is indeed a central character throughout the novel. Sir Leicester takes enormous pride in his family. All the family portraits are hung everywhere in the family home of Chesney Wold. Dickens goes through and describes them, and as he describes them, it's very clear. The portraits are fading, the portraits are dusty, the portraits are part of a past that is dead and gone. And to pretend that there is still a tradition, a living tradition, that is represented by those portraits or by that family name is sheer folly. Sheer folly. What should be the nobility, what should be the role of the nobility, is not being fulfilled. They are so obsessed with the past and living in the past and living in a tradition that is finished that instead of bringing new blood so the tradition is new, alive, fresh, and vital, they have simply perpetuated it until now it is dead. And a central walkway that's important in the novel is simply called the Ghost Walk. And it's as if all of those dead relatives are still there walking through. It's a horrifying portrait. But let me say this quite simply. For those of us who are traditional Catholics, this book should shiver our timbers. Because the fact of the matter is, and I think many people know it, including one voice who keeps warning against 50s-ism, is well aware that something had happened to the church long before the Second Vatican Council, and what seemed to be fine and was going onward had to have become stultified, troubled, empty to a degree, or the collapse would not have been so sudden, so complete, and so profound. We are also aware, and I've heard it from a number of Catholics that I respect who were alive at the time, and even, God bless him, the good Archbishop himself, who served on one of the commissions preparing the documents, there was a hope to revivify the traditions of the Church, not tossing them out, but rather making them part of the immediate world in which contemporary Catholics lived, as opposed to just holding on to things from the past because they were done in the past. And I'm not talking the sacraments or the doctrines. Obviously, those are living tradition. But how does one get those to the sheep? How do the shepherds get them to the sheep? Instead, what happened? The council was hijacked, and the lifelessness of that tradition showed itself by the instantaneous collapse. Dickens is writing about it in Bleak House. There it is. Now, finally, and this is just such a magnificent comic gem. Dickens goes after charity. Organized, phony, crazy charity. And he does it with one of the greatest characters he ever invented, named Mrs. Jellybee. Mrs. Jellybee has a large family, but spends all of her time writing letters, raising money, sending packages, doing whatever she can for the natives of Borioboola-Ga in Africa. Needless to say, there's no such country. Meanwhile, her own children go unwashed, unfed. When the house is visited, one little boy has his head stuck between the railings of a staircase and looks as if he's going to rip his head off before he ever gets it out. There are children tumbling off the roof. It is a mother totally neglecting her own family because she is so obsessed with the well-being of those in a distant country far away with whom she has no real connection. But in doing so, she is an organizer and she can feel superior to everyone around her. It is charity reeking with pride. She has another friend who is named Mrs. Pardiggle. This is just too good. Mrs. Pardiggle is also a proponent of modern charity. Slightly different. "These," said Mrs. Pardiggle, "are my five boys. You may have seen their names in a printed subscription list, perhaps more than one in the position of our esteemed friend Mr. Jarndyce. Egbert, my eldest, 12, is the boy who sent out his pocket money to the amount of 5 and threepence to the Tuckapoo Indians. Oswald, my second, 10 and a half, is the child who contributed 2 and 9 pence to the great National Smithers Testimonial. Francis, my third, 9, 1 and 6 pence halfpenny. Felix, my fourth, 7, 8 pence to the superannuated widows. Alfred, my youngest, 5, has voluntarily enrolled himself in the infant bonds of joy and is pledged never through life to use tobacco in any form." We had never seen such dissatisfied children. It was not merely that they were weazened and shriveled, though they were certainly that too, but they looked absolutely ferocious with discontent. At the mention of the Tuckapoo Indians, I could really have supposed Egbert to be one of the most baleful members of that tribe. He gave such a savage frown. The face of each child, as the amount of his contribution was mentioned, darkened in a peculiar vindictive manner, but his was by far the worst. I must accept, however, the little recruit into the infant bonds of joy, who was stolidly and evenly miserable. It's absolutely brilliant. There is also, and this is one of the painful moments, there is real poverty. Not only are the children being neglected, but out on the streets, and it's pure Dickens, are some very poor, abandoned children. One of them is a young sweep named Joe. And Joe has no parents, nowhere to live, just has his little broom and sweeps the streets. and he lives in a place called Tom All Alone's. That's just the only way I can describe it. When I was in Rio doing research in Brazil for the book on Bishop de Castromayor, I was taken to the worst of the Rio ghettos, just unbelievable poverty. When I read about Tom All Alone's, that's what it reminds me of, an absolute place of horror in which human beings are living. But when we first meet Joe in Tom All Alone's, he is sitting down on the doorstep of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts. And it's that sense of the far away must take precedence, and it must be organized because, as we know, charity now is a multi-billion dollar ripoff. There was a study done recently about how much money was sent out actually in charity or research, and how much was taken by those running the organization, and it was something like 70% to 80% stays in the pockets of the organization. And it's which brings me quickly to Scrooge. I will do this very quickly. If you remember the opening of A Christmas Carol, two men come into Scrooge raising money, okay, hoping that he will contribute. Scrooge refuses them and says, "Are there not workhouses? Are there not prisons?" And they're quite taken aback. At the end of the novel, when Scrooge has had his conversion, his heart has melted, he's become human again, the first thing he does is to look after the Cratchit family. For Dickens, the mark of genuine charity is one-on-one. An individual soul who has something to give, giving to someone else one-on-one, and receiving something in return from it. Tell a little story of my friend Patrick. We were in St. Petersburg, and he'd vowed he wasn't buying any more postcards or picture books because he would just take them home and pile them up, and enough of it. But we're walking out of, which palace was it, Patrick?
Tsarskoye Selo,
the temple of the palace of Nicholas and Alexandra. And there at the exit was a young man on crutches, his leg blown away, obviously in the Chechenian War. And so, of course, Patrick said, and he was selling picture books. Patrick, "I got to buy one." So he went up and bought. He asked him how much. The young man said in American terms, $10. Patrick gave him 20, got the picture book, said, "You know, no, keep the change," started walking off, as he himself says, feeling very fine about himself and his act of charity. He hadn't gotten very far when here comes the young man, racing forward on his crutches, gave Patrick a profound bow, and handed him a packet of picture postcards. And as Patrick said, he realized charity is a two-way street. And that young, wounded soldier gave him much more than he could possibly have given to him. When Scrooge helps the Cratchit family, and indeed we learn helps Tiny Tim to survive, the Cratchits are giving Scrooge something in return that is greater than money. It is the chance to help a family survive, keep together, and pray for their good benefactor. He then bumps into the man on the street and remembers them and gives them something, but it's secondary. It's a tiny... First, charity is individual. Now... Oh, I have to do one more thing. Well, wait, I'll do it at the end. Slight rearrangement. Now, through all of this, Dickens deliberately makes the point that what the system, and I'm just going to call it that now, the courts of justice, the political world, the world of charity, the world of the nobility, what all of these things are doing as part of the system is crushing the individual, designed to destroy the individual. And the way he works that into the novel is number one. This was the most carefully constructed novel he had ever put together. There was always, in the earlier Dickens novel, a little bit of spontaneity where you saw him creating as he went along. In this book, it was planned out ahead of time, and it is brilliantly constructed for a reason. Every member of the social order in Bleak House is connected with every other member. It is a genuine social network, a social fabric. And what is incredible and brilliant is that connections are made that the individuals themselves have no awareness of. But part of that process of discovery is individual A is indeed connected with B, who is connected with C, and in a mysterious way, they have influenced, affected, and changed each other's lives without knowing it, and have the potential to continue doing so now that they know it in a much, much better way than had been done before. To make this point even stronger, this is the only novel Dickens ever wrote that has two narrators. There is the typical third-person omniscient narrator who oversees everything, knows everything, tells us everything, and then he alternates with a first-person narrative of a young woman named Esther Summerson. And half of the book is Esther's narrative. It's the only time Dickens ever had a young woman narrate anything in his fiction. And Esther is crucial to the plot, but she is discovering what's going on as it happens to her. But we have the big overview, and we have the individual. And all I will say is that in terms of the novel, it is the individual who is most important and cannot be crushed and destroyed for a very simple reason. Before he began the novel, Dickens encountered a young woman named Esther Elton. And she had spent a long time simply tending her dying father. She was by her father's bedside, I don't know for how long a time, but it was a long period of time, and she was there for her father to help him through his remaining days on this earth and see him through death and into whatever future awaited him after death. And Dickens was so impressed, he said, she gave an example of patient, womanly devotion, a little piece of quiet, unpretending, domestic heroism. Dickens is often, and by the way, the literary critics disparage Esther out of hand. They call her the great weakness in the novel, and they detest her because she is simple, quiet, honest, unassuming, decent, straightforward, loving, kind, charitable, and they don't like it. Not in the age of the modern woman who's an Amazon going off to fight in Iraq or getting a political position or becoming the president of a corporation, or because the notion is the home and family are a waste of time. Now, we all know what's happened because of this. The private sphere has disappeared. God in his wisdom, male and female, created him them. The man was to be in the public sphere, where he did public work and kept the society whole and running, and indeed defended the moral order outside the home if there was going to be anything inside the home. And the woman was the heart of the home. That was her domain. And not just in terms of what color the curtains were going to be on the window, but also in terms of how the children were brought up, how they were managed, what they ate, what her neighbors were doing, what her connection. This is an absolute truth. Without women in the home, there can be no neighborhoods, period. It's the reason in the modern world no neighbors know each other. Because the women used to, when I was growing up, I knew all the neighbors in every house in the block and about two or three blocks surrounding that. And I could walk into anyone at any time, and they knew who I was. And if I did something that I shouldn't have done, I knew my parents would hear about it in 10 minutes, which kept me good. Fear. Fear is a great means of control. But again, notice it's immediate and personal, because I didn't want to face my father if I was accused of something. But there were neighborhoods because there were mothers in the home. And this will be in tomorrow's lecture. There was art. There was music. There was poetry. There was beauty. And they're gone. Because a woman who is the corporate of the board of the Oslo sardine canning factory doesn't have time to teach poetry or music to her children. The modern home has had a heart attack, and the heart of the home is gone. And the moderns think that's wonderful, and they hate Esther Summerson, and they hate almost all of Dickens' women, especially those who are feminine, loving, charitable, kind, gentle, soft. They detest them. I shouldn't say this, but I don't care. Mm-hmm. Including someone in charge of education in a certain religious group that shall remain nameless, who made the decree that A Tale of Two Cities should not be read by traditional Catholic children because the image of womanhood was just despicable. I'll say no more. I'll get in. Oh, who cares? I'm in trouble. Everybody knows, I hope, who I'm talking about. Now, it is not accidental. Esther is the one who holds the novel together and makes the ending possible. I can't give away plot. Let's just say she suffers. But Dickens being Dickens, she achieves the end we hope for. I'm giving nothing away. That's always the case. But it is not accidental that at some point, and this really riles the modern critics as well, Mrs. Jellyby, having grown tired of Borrio Bulaga, because they have to move from one cause to another, takes up with the following. A young unmarried lady, a Miss Wick. Miss Wick's mission was to show the world that woman's mission was man's mission, and that the only genuine mission of both man and woman was to be always moving declaratory resolution about things in general at public meetings. The guests were few, but were, as one might expect at Mrs. Jellyby's, all devoted to public objects only. He got it. He nailed it. Women heading off into the public sphere, because that's where they can be most like men. And I'm retired now. I go to the supermarket, and I push the cart around. I'm an old retired bachelor school teacher, but I see fathers moving them around, and it's very sad. It's very sad. I won't talk. One of the threads of the plot is Mrs. Jellyby and her daughter. I'll say no more. It's wonderful. Mrs. Jellyby has been disappointed in Borrio Bulaga, which turned out to be a failure in consequence of the king of Borrio Bula wanting to sell everybody for rum. But she had taken up with the rights of women to sit in Parliament, and Caddy tells me it is a mission involving even more correspondence than her old mission. It's quite appropriate. It is very interesting. The house that my housemate and I are renting, we've lived in for 9 years now and maybe knew two of our neighbors. Just before we left to make this trip, there was a block party for all the neighbors on about three or four different sides. I mean, we met neighbors we didn't even know lived anywhere near us. Why was it organized? Why was it done? Two stay-at-home mothers who had moved into the neighborhood and realized they didn't know the neighbors and organized a block party where, when we go back, we are now going to actually know our neighbors by sight. If I'm able to, I'll try to remember some of their names. I need to write this down. I'm old and forgetful. But to wave at, to talk to be aware of, the good these women have done is incalculable, and they were simply being women. Let's just say, in order for the horrible vision presented by Dickens of the system crushing everybody to finally be overturned, it's going to take one precious, motherly, wise, loving, kind woman's heart. Insofar, ladies, as you can bring that to your home, God bless you. But as Catholics, what we wait for, and Dickens somehow knew it, was it will be the triumph of the greatest woman ever, the Virgin Mary, who will crack that rotten system, which is certainly the work of the devil, whose head she will crush. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. What I'm going to do, we've got about a two-minute break. Are there any questions? We're up and running now. So, yes.
A bit of a silly question, but we have this expression in English, what with Dickens or where with Dickens. Is that anything to do with Charles Dickens?
Do you know the question? And it is a common phrase, what the Dickens, or does it have anything to do with Charles Dickens? I don't know. To be quite honest, I don't think so. I think it precedes his fame. But I would have to double check. I've never checked it, and I'm simply speaking from something vaguely in the back of my memory, which at this point is not to be trusted. So I don't know for certain.
I think it's a euphemism for the devil, isn't it? Doesn't it appear in Shakespeare?
Old Dick, yes, exactly. It is indeed, yes, yes. It is. It goes all the way back to Shakespeare's time and was a euphemism from there. So it definitely would predate it. Thank you, I'd completely... Yet one more thing I've forgotten. But that's quite correct, yes, yes. Yes.
Could you clarify what you meant about the female characters in A Tale of Two Cities? Because obviously there's quite a few strong...
There's some very... It's Lucy Manette. It's Lucy Manette, who... by the way, let me just say, I reread Tale of Two Cities recently. Loved it. Just loved it. What Dickens became obsessed with later in his life was sacrifice. Self-denial and sacrifice. And obviously, it's what A Tale of Two Cities is focused on. But it begins with Lucy Manette, who's there when her father is finally released, who cares for him for all those years, who then is in love with Charles Darnay. Her response to Sidney Carton when he professes his love that he knows can never be realized is so charitable, loving, and kind. Without Lucy's female kindness to him, he could not have gone at the end to do what he did. And he does it to save her husband out of love for her and her great kindness. But it's a feminine kindness. It is. And then, of course, what happens for him, that poor trembling little girl he meets who's also going to the guillotine, he befriends and she asks, may I hold your hand that we may... He ends up with this woman at his side that he can now be heroic for as well. It is a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done before. It is a far, far better rest I go to than I have ever known. And for those of us holding the faith here in the Queen of Martyrs house, we should remember that. I have no doubt, I know someone who has said it on occasion, that the church may well be restored through the blood of the martyrs. Some years ago, I thought it might be a slight exaggeration. With each passing day, I'm more convinced that it may well be the case. You can smell it in the air with each passing day. So something to keep in mind. No, I mean, Madame Defarge is strong, and God bless Miss Cross, who is a great Dickens character, who is has been Lucy's what do you call her? What, teacher? She was her guardian. She was there for her. The final battle is between two women. Mm. It's between Miss Pross and the evil Madame Defarge. Well, the result of it is Miss Pross sacrifices her hearing. That gun goes off, and it is so loud she is deafened for the... Here I am giving the plot away. I said I assume you know Tale of Two Cities. The gun goes off and she is deafened for the rest of her life. She sacrifices her hearing for this young woman she loves, but the reward is she's still part of that family, and she now gets to help bring up the new children that are coming along, even if she can't hear them. It's about sacrifice. Let me say one other thing. It was mentioned in the Dickens house, and it's true. Dickens had this association with Ellen Ternan, an actress. He had separated from his wife. It was a public scandal. There wasn't a divorce, but they separated. They were no longer living together. He became devoted to Ellen Ternan, spent much time with her. This has happened with many older artists. They're susceptible. It happened with Ibsen. It happened with composer Leos Janacek. There are others. I can't think of them right now. Verdi, near the end of his life, his wife was upset. There was a young singer he got interested in. But Peter Aykroyd, in his biography, builds this case. The other fundamental moment in Dickens' life was when he held the dying Mary Hogarth, who was apparently an absolutely the kind of young woman that keeps reappearing in Dickens' novels. Loving, soft, sweet, charitable, with almost with an angelic side. And he held that as a model, and modeled so many of the young women after her. Now, in Great Expectations, the heroine is a bit cold and distant, and that is Estella. But there is still something, a core in her, that by the end, Dickens writes a new happy ending. Peter Aykroyd makes the case that if there had been a real affair between Dickens and Ellen Ternan, he thinks it would have been such a violation of the image the young Mary that it would have disturbed him. Instead of being newly inspired, he might have had to quit writing. I think it's a good case. We will never know. We will never know. Back then, the private world was private, and there would be hints of things in newspapers, but they didn't have films and ghastly things, but rumors were everywhere. I don't know. I like to think the best of people when I can, and I was pleased with Aykroyd's suggestion, and I found it fairly convincing. It's not my business, it's God's business. As someone said recently, who am I to judge? I'll just say one thing. Somebody on one of the websites just posted a simple comment about You Know Who that said, please, somebody, stuff a sock in his mouth. how sad that this is what we've come to. But there it is. So, any other questions? Well, then what I'll do is this, since I know that there is more food being prepared for us. Yes.
Does Dickens make a link with the people we cannot talk about?
Oh boy, does he? Does he? Oliver Twist, the evil character who's running the boys to steal throughout London, is Fagin, and he got in terrible trouble because of it. When the great film by David Lean was made in the late 40s, it could not be released in America for 3 years. Because of Alec Guinness's spot-on portrayal of Fagin. So, now, at the end of his life, he met some people who objected strongly, and in his last novel, he has a rather kindly old man who has a small role and is nice. And I remember one of the dearest people I knew in Annapolis was a, I call her the cheese lady. She ran a little cheese shop. Absolutely lovely, lovely woman. And so there are, you know, again, it was based, I think, on somebody he knew. I'm not sure in any case, but it's certainly there. Just those two cases, I think. I could be wrong.
Shake Me Up, Judy, Bleak House.
Oh, yeah.
Smallweed.
Yeah. Oh, the Smallweeds. Oh, how could I forget them? We're going to talk about them tomorrow. Thank you. See, the mind is going. The mind is going. Forgetful. Here we go. Since we are about to dine, we will have Mr. Chadband, a phony evangelical preacher, give the first blessing. My friends, what is this which we now behold as being spread before us? Refreshment. Do we need refreshment then, my friends? We do. And why do we need refreshment, my friends? Because we are but mortal, because we are but sinful, because we are but of the earth, because we are not of the air. Can we fly, my friends? We cannot. Why can we not fly, my friends? I say, my friends, why can we not fly? Is it because we are calculated to walk? It is. Could we walk, my friends, without strength? We could not. What should we do without strength, my friends? Our legs would refuse to bear us. Our knees would double up. Our ankles would turn over, and we should come to the ground. Then from whence, my friends, in a human point of view, do we derive the strength that is necessary to our limbs? Is it from bread in various forms, from butter which is churned from the milk, which is yielded unto us by the cow, from the eggs which are laid by the fowl, from ham, from tongue, from sausage, and from like? It is. Then let us partake of the good things which are set before us. For those of us who grew up Protestant, we remember such sermons. Thank you. Thank you very much.